welcome to another in a series of 3NR podcasts. I'm Scott Phillips, joined by
Bill Batterman and
Roy Lefkowitz. Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you tuned in last week, we hope you liked it. We hope that you'll like what we have to rant about tonight. Scott, go ahead.
All right, so the first thing that I want to talk about is a trend in the politics disad, which is people reading these impacts to healthcare reform that are basically, in my mind, just winner's win scenarios that say essentially if Obama doesn't get a win on healthcare, he won't be able to advance some other part of his agenda. Most notably, climate change has been an impact read like this, but also START on the Middle East peace process. So here's kind of my objection to this is that these impacts operate kind of the opposite way of the premise of the political capital disad. The political capital disad says political capital is finite. When you do something, you spend it. You can't get it back. So spending capital means that he won't have all the capital he needs for healthcare. Okay, but this impact says it, he needs to spend capital on healthcare so that he will have capital to spend on something else, which is basically the premise of the AFS winner's win link turn. So it doesn't really make sense to me to read this on the negative as an impact to the DA because you can't answer the winner's win turn by saying political capital is finite because that would therefore take out the impact to your disad. So what do you think about that, Batterman? Do you think I'm right here?
I agree. I think the only way that you can read a scenario like that is if your link argument is that the plan is a loss for Obama and that hurts Obama, not that the passage to the plan would be a win because he will use his political capital to get it passed. So if I was the AF in the 2AC and I read a winner's win turn, I would say that either winner's win is true, in which case the link turn outweighs the link, or it's not true, in which case there's no impact to the other agenda items. And then I would just read impact turns to healthcare and force the neg to read to defend the healthcare impact, because I think the reason people are reading dissats like that is because they don't want to defend the impact to healthcare. They want to defend the impact of something else, but they can't overcome the uniqueness problems. I don't understand why people haven't made better answers to those dissats. I don't know how much longer the political climate will mean that those dissats make sense, but I definitely think that there's a contradiction between the link argument and the internal link argument that people are reading with those dissats.
Well, to me, the thing is that I think people are reading it just because they have absolutely no clue what the healthcare reform process entails at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, they just don't even know what impacts they can read. And, like, if the other team said there's no internal link, that doesn't assume the current healthcare reform, I really think they just would be unable to explain what it is about healthcare reform that's going to pass that would, like, solve for bioterror, like that stupid, like, Sklar impact card.
Right.
That's kind of why it's strategic, because you can't really – it's a way of getting at those impacts because those scenarios have no uniqueness claims. Like, there's not good evidence for all those other bills passing, and the risk of healthcare being impact turned is probably not, you know, the case because healthcare is likely to pass. I mean, the dissent is obviously bad, but I think that in that sense it is strategic in that you get to access other impacts, you know, via healthcare without having to debate about healthcare on the impact level.
Well, the thing that I think that kind of goes against what you're saying is that...
Oh, I don't agree. I don't think it's a great DA. I'm just saying that it helps you try to get out of those uniqueness arguments by sort of saying that healthcare provides uniqueness for everything.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I just think that, like, that maybe makes sense for, like, the START impact, but climate change and the peace process just seem like so... they have even less of a chance of passing than healthcare. So, like, healthcare would really have to be a pretty gigantic win to make everyone afraid enough of Obama to be like, cap and trade, let's do that.
Yeah. And at this point, it's not just passing anything that would be a win. Obama would have to push something through that he wants. So whether that's the public option or something a little bit more extreme or kind of harder healthcare reform, but the uniqueness claim that people usually make when they read this dissent is just that some healthcare reform will pass, and then the link argument is that the plan would derail healthcare reform in totality. But I don't think anyone at this point really thinks no healthcare reform is going to pass. Something will pass, and the internal link cards assume that Obama pushes through the public option or something of that nature, and that that's key to his political capital. So the uniqueness argument doesn't make a lot of sense either. I think that even when you read that version of the diss ad, I think you still need to win that public option will pass or some other comprehensive or formal pass in order to win that the DA is unique.
Well, I think you raise a good point there, because definitely at Greenhill, I mean, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago, so maybe it's changed, but a lot of the healthcare debates where there was like uniqueness, non-uniqueness cards getting read were just totally stupid, because the nag would be like, a moderate version of healthcare will pass, and then the AF would be like, non-unique public option won't pass. And it's like they're totally non-responsive to each other.
Mm-hmm. And the worst part is that the impacts that people then read to healthcare itself assume either universal coverage or other massive expansions, like that Star card assumes the coverage of everyone, including immigrants, and you know the Business Week card about the healthcare cost derailing the economy is about universal coverage. And so if the NIG doesn't win that universal coverage will pass, then I don't think they should get access to those impacts. But AFs never want to point that out or make that defensive argument.
I agree with you, but the funny part was I was reading an article in, I think, Time this week.
Reading an article is funny.
That's actually on a kick on something I want to talk about later. But in this Time magazine article, the author was just like, if Obama gets health care, it'll help bolster his political capital to do X and Y. And this author just doesn't even talk about what type of health care bill that would pass or anything like that. Just like, as long as Obama gets health care, he'll garner political capital, which seems kind of preposterous because we all know that at some level some health care bill will exist. How watered down it is a different issue.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good point for like the importance of author qualifications, is that it's not just debaters who don't understand healthcare reform. There is a large amount of journalists writing these uniqueness cards who literally have no idea what they are talking about. Like, do not know what the terms like universal coverage or public option or any of this stuff even means. And so they write these cards that are just totally ridiculous given, you know, I don't know, reality. And then people read them in debates and it's just like taken as gospel.
Yeah. The other thing is people, I've noticed, I've been following the sites that have been posted on the, even the college wiki, and a lot of people are citing, you know, very strange sources for these uniqueness arguments on healthcare. A lot of people are citing just the Huffington Post, which doesn't make a lot of sense because that's just, regardless of what the article is, it's written by someone, not just by the Huffington Post. But like,
yeah, I think they do that when it's like an Alec Baldwin article.
That's right, exactly. And it's
Post.
Like, it seems
Did
like
Jared Stroh posts on the Huffington Post once.
Yeah, you can. I think almost anyone can post on the Huffington Post. It just depends on whether it's a blog entry or like an official article. But people should like make arguments about why evidence from the New York Times or the Washington Post or whatever should be preferred, because it's you know, a more qualified political correspondence as opposed to these like op-eds and these like you know, left-wing or right-wing blogs and all this. Those uniqueness arguments, like I didn't have to resolve any uniqueness debates either at Greenhill or at our tournament, but if I would have had to, you know, kind of reading the affidavit cards, it's very difficult to judge those debates because they're just like assertions by both sides that aren't really grounded in reality. So I think that debaters, you know, it's important to have evidence that says it will or won't pass, but it's also important to kind of have a reason or a, you know, a warrant for that grounded in some qualification or some, you know, element of reality, because otherwise it's just hard to judge those debates, I think.
Speaking of things that don't have reality or any qualifications, let's talk about the debate you two judged with regard to Nietzsche.
All right, so why don't you start off here, Bill, because you had kind of a little rant about this at the end of the round.
Certainly.
So I guess I'll play devil's advocate and, dear God, defend the Nietzsche critique of all
things. this debate was the double occupational at the Greenhill tournament. It was Whitney Young on the affirmative defending an AF that provided like universal full employment, and Glenbrook South, Phil Saylor and Samantha Varney on the negative, and they went for a kind of very hard version of the Nietzsche critique. And my problem at the end of the debate, and kind of what I talked about, is that in debates where the negative, or I guess in some cases the affirmative, but the Nietzsche team defends kind of a revaluation of all values and kind of contests whether there is such a thing as good or bad or whether we can figure that out. It makes it difficult for me to filter the rest of the arguments in the debate through a lens of a value. Normally when you're making a decision, you kind of decide, what do we value, and then based on those values we make a decision. But if all values are called into question, it's hard to ground decisions, and I guess that's kind of the point, but at the same time, that point applied to debate judging or debate arguments makes it very difficult for me to wrap my head around kind of how to evaluate competing claims. And then the other part of that is just that when there's no such thing as good or evil, or when values need to be reevaluated or contested, I'm not sure why anything can be considered bad. So I'm not sure why sort of the DA portion of the critique argument is an offensive reason to vote against the course of action proposed by the AF. So just in the end, it seems like the best case for the negative is that the judge abandons all values, reevaluates all values, and then votes negative just because the negative wins by default when there is no value to the affirmative. But I struggle with how that argument, the Nietzsche argument in general, becomes an offensive kind of disadvantage against proposed changes. And that's something that I had trouble with in this debate, for sure, because I thought the negative was technically very sound and did a good job of extending the argument, and it in parts it made a lot of sense. But at the same time, kind of bottom line at the end of the evaluation of those arguments, it's hard to know kind of why to vote negative. And I thought that your decision made a lot of sense, but I'd be interested to hear what you kind of think about that specific issue or as it applied to that round.
Well, I think the first thing is that the way you described it as like a hardcore version of it, I thought was very true in that there was almost no debate tech or trickery being employed to kind of spice up their argument. It was very much just kind of like almost an impact turn to alleviating suffering. And so I agree with you that that's kind of a hard pill to swallow. I guess a couple of things that I think that teams who have been more successful with Nietzsche as a whole do to kind of deal with the problems that you isolated is, first, I think that you have to draw a distinction between a rejection of kind of universal values / slave morality and values in general. And so I think you're kind of right that it's hard for a judge, if they reject all values, to figure out why to vote negative.
That's
and so
not our Nietzsche.
Yeah. I think what the neg basically needs to do is they need to isolate something particular about the affirmative, or a particular value, rather. In most cases, it's going to be some kind of, like, hatred of life / resentment nonsense. And basically, kind of deploy a counterplan. So the way this was explained to me that made sense was, if someone is being attacked, you can intervene out of fear, okay, or you could intervene out of, like, some kind of courageous aspiration. And so Nietzsche doesn't necessarily say, like, you should never intervene to, like, stop suffering. It's when, like, the totalizing fear of suffering, like, takes over your life and creates a bunker mentality where, like, you're never willing to take risk in order to avoid, potential suffering, that's like what resentment is. It's not like, oh, there's a bus coming, I can't step out of the way because suffering is inevitable. And so, like, I think what the negative wants to do is characterize the affirmative as being kind of like, this neurotic quest to avoid any low risk, high magnitude impact scenario, and say that kind of paranoid fear mongering interferes with, like, the true aspirations of living a life that which is virtuous, full of things like courage and whatnot. So do you find that distinction to be more meaningful, Bill, than just the idea like, the AF endorses some kind of value which draws a line between good and evil and we shouldn't do that?
Yeah, for sure. And that, I think...
That is the dumbest thing ever. Everything that he just said is... When teams explain that to me, that makes me go crazy. The AF is never fearful. It's like, we would like to prevent a nuclear war. That would not be a good idea. But the AF is never like, in order to prevent nuclear wars, we need to do this. It's like, we should do good things, and as a result, we prevent nuclear wars. It's not like, nuclear war will only come if we do this. That's why they present the advantage first and then the impacts. Am I crazy here?
Did you understand what you just said, Bill?
I'm not exactly sure. I think the argument, like the security version of the link argument, the Derridian stuff from the 1995 book, kind of makes the argument that Scott was explaining in terms of international relations. But I guess when the distinction between fearing impact and just, you know, kind of acting because of them. I'm not sure if that's entirely important. I think the argument that the negative makes or should make is just that taking political action, grounding our political action in a desire to avoid security threats or to avoid, you know, impending economic collapse or whatever, makes us kind of have a critical or pessimistic view toward the world as it is, which, you know, their argument is that that undermines the, you know, value of life. So I don't know, I'm not sure what that distinction does or means necessarily. I think that's one of the other problems with these debates is that there are kind of these kind of broad narratives on both sides that never really get debated. They're just kind of presumed. But the thing that helps for me when teams are going for Nietzsche or some of these other kinds of arguments is just to talk more about the affirmative. So like in the debate that Scott and I judged, the affirmative read a piece of evidence that defended employment in terms of its ability to essentially just make people happy or to, you know, give people value to their lives. And if the negative talked more about why that isn't true or why that is a link to the negative's argument without just saying it's a link but actually explaining that, then I think that teams can do a lot better with those types of arguments. But I still have trouble resolving kind of what value to use as a judgment. I understand the distinction between universal values, I guess, and maybe contingent values. And so I guess if I would be interested to hear a debate where the negative made that distinction, just kind of see how I would respond to that or how I would be persuaded by that. But that is a distinction that makes sense that I would certainly be interested in hearing a debate about.
Well, see, that card, I think, obviously the neg didn't say this, but that's the kind of card that if I was reading this critique, I would be, like, ecstatic that the 2AC read, because I think that lends itself so well to, like, you know, basically a pick argument that there are potential, like, valuable or, like, laudable justifications for full employment, like the fact that, you know, work allows you to, like, express yourself and gives life some kind of meaning. And so if that was the only affirmative advantage, I think you would have a tough time winning a link to this argument. But when that's, like, you know, deployed as, like, a footnote to the idea that we need to do the plan to prevent, you know, impending economic collapse or whatever, that I think that certainly is not consistent in terms of, you know, at least definitely the negative's link argument. I think that the part that, you know, maybe Roy's having a problem with is that I think Roy is a big fan of the, like, do the right thing for the wrong reason kind of argument where, like, you know, these basically, like, reps picks, essentially, Roy just finds unpersuasive. And I think that's true. It's, like, it is difficult for the negative to, like, win that this is kind of, like, I don't even know, I guess it would be, like, philosophically competitive or something. But I think that
do the right thing for the wrong reason, though. I mean, Whitney Young, the way their app is written is maybe a little bit different, but most apps claim advantages that are like, we should do things because they're good and they prevent nuclear war. But the 1AC is never like, you know, 98% of the 1ACs are not like, nuclear war is coming tomorrow and this is the only solution. Unless you do this, we will all die. They're all terminal impacts or reasons why the app is a good idea, but it's never the grounded justification for doing the app. That's what I was trying to explain earlier.
I think what the negative is saying is that there could be a lot of reasons why work would be important, and the idea that we should do work in order to avoid future suffering is not the best justification for it. And in fact, that justification, you know, starts the kind of philosophical inertia towards resentiment.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I don't even know what resentiment means, so.
I resentiment
this conversation.
I mean, basically, Roy, like, let's say there's a hypothetical person, we'll just call this person KW, and this person is so angry at everything that goes on in their life that they just live to be bitter. All right, that's like what resentiment is. It's when you lose all like positive sense of satisfaction and just live like in negation of things outside of yourself. So you hate your life, hate the world, etc. And so this person, KW, we could say is so negative that there's not value to their existence.
I'm sorry, I was trying to figure out who KW was while you were talking about this. So.
It'll click later.
All right, moving on. I don't care. I mean, seriously, this conversation is...
You like to defend yourself as a good judge for the K, though, Roy.
I am a good judge for the K, but this is not K-talk. This is just gibberish here.
Here's the thing. Roy is not a good judge for the K. He's a good judge for the K debated like a DA.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you go for it like a DA, it's almost impossible for you not
like,
to
Roy win. Will, if you take the K for 8 minutes and read like 35 cards, that's like, you have like 99% chance of getting Roy's ballot.
The K is a DA. People just, it's a DA and CP all in one. If you go for it as the alt solves your case and avoids the turn, boom. But if you go for it like with Resentiment, you're gonna Resentiment this decision.
How long have you been waiting to make that joke?
I mean, for the whole time while I was eating my dinner while you all were talking about this.
Okay. You got anything else on Nietzsche, Bill?
That's about it.
Thank God. Moving on.
I will say that this could be an example of where perusing judge philosophies could help out a little bit, because seeing Bill's judge philosophy and its comments about Heidegger, I would not think that Nietzsche would be a good decision in general when debating in front of Bill.
True. For sure.
Which is interesting, though, because you are a giant hack for the Cap K.
Also true.
How do you rectify that? The difference is
that in the case of it depends on the version of the capitalism K, but A.
Yeah, so you, I'm guessing you like the old school Marxism and hate the, like, Zizek.
Exactly.
Okay. That makes sense.
What's the difference?
There's a value and a policy relevance to the argument that, capitalism is bad and that socialist solutions are better. Whereas these kind of ontology critiques or even the Nietzsche argument, they just aren't very policy relevant, and so I have a hard time incorporating some of the impact narratives into a discussion of what the federal government should do. So they rely a lot more on framework questions. The bottom line is just that they rely on framework arguments that go against kind of my fundamental beliefs about debate. And so they're a much more difficult sell than a critique that's more policy relevant.
Sure. Yeah. All right. Next topic. We're done with this. We got a question with regards to 1AR theory. This question was asked by someone named, well, we'll keep their name anonymous. Let's just say their name is Schmellis Allen. Schmellis Allen asks, do we have some thoughts on extending theory in the 1AR? It's sort of like the Goldilocks. It's a little too hot, a little too cold, too much time, too little time. How do you sort of prep that effectively? And sort of what should the rule of thumb be? Because sometimes judges are like, you should have spent more time, you should have spent less time. You guys have some thoughts on that? Scott, you were 1A for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's essentially two things that you can do. Is one, you can just like extend it enough to mess with a 2NR, but not really well enough to go for it. And that should probably take you between like 20 and 30 seconds. And then if you want to extend it well enough to go for it, I think if you write out ahead of time an efficient block and are, you know, at least reasonably quick, you should be able to do that in 45 seconds to a minute. If you're going to do the first one, I think you should just have like written out a set of like 6 or 7 arguments that kind of, you know, respond to most of the things the negative says, but don't really get in depth in them. You know, more just like a re-explanation of 2AC offense with some quick answers to common negative arguments. And the second way, I think you should, you know, again, write out an efficient block, but basically have a short overview that kind of explains your key offense and make sure you say it's a voting issue. And answers reject the argument, not the team, because every neg is going to say that. And then write out embedded clash answers to the common arguments. So, like, if you're debating conditionality, you know the negative is going to say, well, it's real world. So have written out, you know, not real world and kind of an answer.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The one thing, or I guess two things. First thing is I think it would be helpful for the 1AR if the 2AC read better theory blocks, which both means a little bit longer in a lot of cases, or answer the logical response that the negative is going to make before they get a chance to make it. So instead of just kind of, you know, laundry listing your reasons that conditionality is bad and then saying voting issue, fairness, and education, kind of take into account what you know that the negative is going to say and incorporate that into the first line so that in the 1AR you're more extending an argument as opposed to developing it in the first instance. And then the second thing is I think the 1AR needs to begin to do the kind of distillation of their theory argument into the components that they're going to go for versus the components that they're not going to go for, and then start the weighing process. So in addition to the kind of lineup blocks and the embedded clash sort of modules that you need to prepare for, you also should have like a, you know, fairness outweighs education, or education outweighs fairness, or logical policymaking outweighs other impacts, or whatever the impact is that you're going for. You want to start that impact comparison in the 1ER, because I think in too many cases that impact comparison doesn't start until the 2AR in cases where the F goes for theory and then judges err negative because the 2AR was making arguments that the negative didn't have a chance to respond to. So those would be the two other things that I would add. But I do think that there are a lot of judges that would be very amenable to affirmatives extending theory arguments and going for theory arguments, whether that's conditionality or the state's counterplan is bad, or critique alternatives are bad, whatever. So I think that a team that decides to go for theoretical arguments more frequently on the affirmative does have a pretty good chance of winning some ballots that maybe they wouldn't be able to win otherwise. I mean, I would say if you are kind of a borderline clearing team, it would be a good idea to get up on conditionality bad, or to get up on states bad, or whatever, and try and win some debates like that, because that can, you know, one or two wins on conditionality bad can really change the way that people debate against you. So I wouldn't, I know that Mellis Schmalen is not someone who would fit that characterization, but hopefully some of the people that are reading this or listening to this do, and I think that might be something to invest some time in, because it doesn't take a ton of time to, if you're the 1A, to get your 1AR on something like conditionality pretty good to go, and that investment can pay off, I think.
Go ahead, Roy.
I have three things that come to mind with this. The first is that the understated messing with the 2NR, just like the value of messing with the 2NR is huge, because if you spend 20 seconds in the 1AR on conditionality, and the 2NR spends 45 seconds or a minute in the 2NR on conditionality, then you're giving a 4-minute 2NR versus a 5-minute 2AR, which puts the app in just like great position, even if you don't go for conditionality. So I think that that's like underexploited by the 1AR, because the 1AR is all about winning time back from the block. And if you can get them to give a 4-minute 2NR versus a 5-minute 2AR, you're in great shape. The second point is that Brian Smith, who debated for Pace Academy in Dartmouth, did this, and he did this really well, was that he had all of his conditionality, 1AR conditionality stuff on one sheet of paper, and he would make it seem as if he wasn't flowing the negative on conditionality, but he would quickly put a dashed line or a mark next to the arguments that he needed to make on this conditionality block. So while some of the, you know, a wily negative team might look over and see that the 1AR isn't flowing, he had sort of a pre-written block with everything on one sheet of paper, and he answered everything, and he would try to catch team off guard there. And then the last thing is just like, people get too stuck and too worried about the minutia of answering arguments. It's just like, if you just sort of say why your argument is more important than theirs, I don't think that you needed to make it about, you know, you made 48 answers to conditionality, and we need to answer every single one of those 48. You just sort of need to win one or two reasons why conditionality is bad, and then all of their other reasons kind of go away.
Yeah, I think what you said about block writing and having that ready is really important, because, firstly, it always gives you something you can extend perfectly in the 1AR with almost zero prep time. And so that's huge. I mean, just like knowing that you have that fallback if you're getting waxed on something else. But second, I mean, if you just put in the time, if you're like a sophomore in high school listening to this, if you just spend like 2 hours writing an unbelievable conditionality 1AR, I mean, you're going to use that for the next, what, like 6 or 7 years of debate, and you'll always, you know, it'll always be there. I often think that, like, if people would just be ready to give, you know, a 5-minute 1AR on conditionality when they know after the block that they're basically done. I mean, I see a lot of teams who just, like, they're done after the block, but still, like, just because they're not familiar with theory, you know, putter along, running out the clock on other issues where they have no shot. And, I mean, Bill is absolutely right that if you just, like, stomp some team on conditionality in the elim of a tournament, that will affect the way other teams prepare to debate you for like a long time afterwards. And so having that in your arsenal is like a pretty good deterrent from the negative, you know, doing crazy like multiple counterplans, which seems to be the norm emerging now in high school debate.
Let me ask you two a question. This is sort of related to what you just said. In the Octos of Mutri, or the Octos of Greenhill, Ushir against Westminster. The 1AR spent, I'd say, 2.5 minutes of the 1AR on states, and it was sort of the only option that he, you know, the 2AR really had to go for. But you talked about like a 5-minute 1AR on conditionality. Maybe conditionality, well, conditionality is definitely different than states, but if like a 1AR went all in like 5 minutes on states, do you really think that the negative wouldn't just win every single time if it had to be 5 minutes versus 5 minutes? I think that the 5-minute thing kind of puts you at like a huge disadvantage. I think that it needs to be like one good minute and then do enough on the other sheets of paper to make the 2NR have to spend time elsewhere, because I just think it's tough enough 5 versus 5 versus 5 world for the app to win.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's better if you can extend other stuff. But I think that, you know, you have to realize that people, the majority of people in high school are not giving 1ARs where they're doing like a devastating job on conditionality in 1 minute and then also covering everything else, you know.
The other thing is it depends on the quality of the 2NC or the 1NR. It seems like a lot of teams' answers, their front line check conditionality is really weak and underdeveloped. In those situations, if 1AR is 5 minutes, the 2NR has to make a lot of new arguments. And so I don't know if that's necessarily bad for the affirmative. If the 1AR is doing a lot of comparison and preempting a lot of the explanation that the 2NR is likely to give, then the 2AR kind of gets free rein to answer all of the new stuff that the 2NR said, and they kind of already have the framework for winning the debate that the 1AR established. So, I mean, I guess it depends on the quality of the block in addition to the quality of the 1AR, but it does depend kind of debate to debate maybe.
I think also the number of people giving the 2N, particularly in high school, but even in college, who have actually had practice giving a 2NR on conditionality after the 1AR has done more than just like cursorily extend three things and didn't drop like a bunch of stupid arguments like time skew inevitable and whatnot. But just like not very many people have been put in that position, and you'd be surprised at the number of good debaters who after a 1AR has been like slow and articulate but made 4 or 5 arguments to all the garbage reasons why, you know, 50 state fiat is legitimate. Like, that's pretty tough to come back from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I just think that we're definitely in agreement that in an optimal world, you make it a minute or a minute and a half and make it tough for the 2NR, because you don't want to be in a 5 versus 5 versus 5 world. And one last thing on theory, or for me at least, is in this debate, it sort of accentuated one of the big problems I have with theory, which is something being bad versus something being a voting issue. Like, yes, you know, 50 state fiat might not be great, or, you know, but why is that a reason why the team should lose? And it's not sort of why is it a voting issue, but why is it a bad enough thing that, yes, it makes debate harder, yes, it causes these things, impacting your theory arguments, not just in the sense of it has to be a voting issue, but explaining why, you know, why something is so hard that you can't win in that world versus it being hard. Because debate is hard. Lots of things make debate difficult for the app. Why is this enough of a reason why they should lose versus any other thing? Crickets. Okay.
Moving on. I don't know that I necessarily agree with that. Like, it's just there's not a lot of good options for reparations in debate. It's not like football where you can have, like, a 5-yard penalty or a 15-yard penalty. Like, if the negative does something that's unfair, I just think a lot of times just removing that argument is not very good.
No, yeah. I mean, I'm just like 50, like, it hurts education. Okay. You know, great. So what?
Like, well, I think the argument that the affirmative needs to be making is that debate is not hard. It's not that debate is hard because of something the negative did. It's that debate is unproductive, and debate is not a true test of preparation and research and critical thinking and all that. And so the game that is played in a world where the negative gets to do whatever it is the negative does is not a good game. And the only kind of remedy, I think I'm definitely in Scott's camp, to those types of arguments or to the initiation of those arguments is to reject the team, because otherwise it just makes the reading of those arguments kind of a no-risk proposition. It just means that they can grant a theoretical objection in order to kick out of their counterplan or whatever. And I think that the kind of neg flex, you know, the negative gets to just say reject the argument of the team, and the app should still be able to beat the rest of the things the negative has said. I think that was the dominant ideology for a long time, and I think that's why the negative has gotten away with so much kind of nonsense, and it's why we see, you know, two or three counterplans and a critique alternative that is not really an opportunity cost of the plan and all that. And so I do think there's a case to be made that those types of counterplans are reasons to reject the team. But I do agree with Roy that in most debates, the affirmative is not doing the kind of explanation required to get past that threshold. But I don't think...
I'm fully on your side on all that stuff. I think that they're not saying the middle part of what you said, which is unproductive debates, this, that, and the other. They're just saying it's a voting issue. It killed education.
Yeah, you know? I don't think that's an argument.
Without explaining, you know, the beef behind why the theory argument is a voting issue.
Yeah, I really think the most analogous thing in my mind to, like, illegitimate counterplans is, like, steroid use in baseball. It's not that steroid use in baseball is bad because it makes baseball harder for other people. It's that it gives certain people such a huge edge that it compromises the validity of the game. And I think three counterplans is not just making it a little tougher on the AF. It's literally making it a situation where a perfect 2AC cannot put you in a good position. And that's, like, not the way the game should be played.
And even if the 2AC does kind of cover or respond or whatever, just the quality of those debates is terrible because the amount of depth on any one issue that's extended in the 201R is so much less than it otherwise would have been. And it just makes the game a lot less, you know, kind of fruitful or whatever for everyone. So even if you've done the research, even if you've done the preparation, you are put in a position where you don't really have a fair chance, and even if you execute perfectly, the debate is still kind of unfulfilling in the end. And so I think that that's definitely something that affirmative should make, or a way that they can phrase that. I really like that steroid analogy. I think we'll probably incorporate that into our theory blocks.
Yeah, I think I agree that if I was seeing teams read three counterplans and a critique who then in the block, like, made good decisions and collapsed the debate to a few issues and, like, just used that as the starting point and then made the debate better, I would be much more amenable to thinking that that was good for debate. But that's not the way it happens, you know? It's like three hypergenerics and the ZZK, and then the block just, like, goes for whatever they were going to go for anyway, regardless of what the 2AC covers or undercovers, and then the 2NR, you know, ends up going for the same thing at 20 debates in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like if you use conditionality actually the way it's supposed to be used to, like, put pressure on the affirmative and make strategic decisions based on it, that would make sense. But, like, I just don't believe the 2NRs anymore when they're like, you know, oh, debate should be tough, improves the quality of debates. Like, no, it doesn't. They spent 8 minutes on the cap K in the 2AC, and you went for it anyway. Like, why? How did conditionality improve this debate?
Yeah, for sure. I agree.
You believe the 2NRs? You used to believe the 2NRs?
Well, I mean, there certainly have been debaters who were versatile enough. They would read a big 1NC, and they would choose to go.
Yeah.
You know, but now you see teams that, like...
Bad. That was the reason why conditionality was bad, because those debaters were versatile. Now
see,
if they're going
see, that's logical. That's logical that conditionality would be worse in the hands of someone actually able to use it. But I find it more offensive when people read three counterplans and a K when they have no intention of ever going for anything other than the K, like even if you drop a counterplan in a DA.
Yeah. Fair enough. Do we want to do some more questions that we got here, or what's the deal?
Yeah, I think we sufficiently beat this one into the ground, probably.
And that one's probably, it's a dead horse that is being,
dead horse.
Being beaten alone.
Do we want to talk about this issues question email that we got today?
Sure.
So we got an email from a prominent director asking us sort of the merits of disclosure in Lincoln Douglas. And the email goes on to say that one point that was brought up is that coaches should not cut cards or produce materials for students because it destroys limits / their educational experience. A couple of people said it was unethical for coaches to be doing debate work. And they asked us to sort of discuss that. What do you all think?
All right. Well, first of all, anyone who's against disclosure or casebooks, et cetera, is an idiot, okay? Because the thing that differentiates debate from every other extracurricular activity, and I'm including in this things like Model UN, even other types of debate, quite frankly, is that it's academic. And in academia, you don't get to, like, hide from other people in your field. It's not, like, people who write, you know, books and papers and stuff, they don't, like, not publish their footnotes because they don't want other people to check the validity of their arguments. The whole idea is that debate is like a marketplace of ideas. And so the fact that people would try and hide by not disclosing or not putting their sites on a case list, that's just, like, ridiculous to me. And it just makes debate seem like, you know, is debate going to evolve to, like, football where, like, coaches talk to their debaters with, like, a hand over their mouth with, like, worry there's, like, lip readers? Like, it's just, like, ridiculous. And I just don't understand at all how people can think that it's educational to not disclose or not put things on a casebook. I mean, every year that I've been at the Glenbrooks and sat in the judges' lounge, I hear these other people complaining. I mean, let's be honest. I hear old people complaining about how other teams, the coaches do all the work for them and like dot, dot, dot. And every year I sit in that judges lounge, like cutting cards for my kids, knowing that my kids are going to have like more recent arguments, debate more issues and have better evidence on them as these people just like sit and complain and like shoot the breeze with one another, doing nothing productive. How can that possibly compromise the education that my kids are going to get more information, even though they didn't cut it? Well, their coach is just like off twiddling their thumbs.
To explain your reference there even more, in high school, my high school coach, if she judged the team that we were debating, she would not tell us the arguments that that team was reading because she thought it was unethical for her to tell me what those teams were saying in the debate round. So she'd be like, good luck, have fun, and she would not tell us what either the app or disads or what the strategy this team went for was. That part's obviously preposterous.
I just don't get it. Like, if you play football and you've never debated, like, you know, a zone defense somehow, and then you play a zone defense, no one would ever say that your football coach should not tell you how to beat a zone defense because that's uneducated. Like, that's the purpose of a coach. Like, that's what coaches do. I don't understand. I mean, we have to do more than just drive the bus, or what are we doing here?
Yeah, and we've had this discussion in Wisconsin. There are a lot of those, some of those people that you saw in the judges' lounge probably are Wisconsinites. But there are a couple of things. I think the first thing is that the philosophy of a lot of the LD coaches that object to casebooks and to disclosure and to sharing of information is instead of valuing engagement with arguments, they value evasion from arguments, and that's kind of the culture. That's the way a lot of rounds are judged. They're purely based on kind of which arguments were answered, which arguments were not answered. It's a very technical, kind of hyper-technical, flow-oriented judging where the substance of the arguments isn't as important as whether or not they were refuted, or not even refuted, but just kind of referenced. And so the engagement portion of debate where we kind of, you know, listen to the arguments on the other side and then engage those arguments and try and beat those arguments on their merits, that part of debate is not emphasized. And I think that's the kind of underlying difference between those who support casebooks and those who support coach research and those who support active coaching and all of that is that they value the process of engaging arguments and with, you know, preparing to engage with arguments. And that's actually one of the, you know, referencing the theory discussion we had before, that's one of the ways that I think I found most persuasive theoretical arguments, especially affirmative theory arguments against the negative, is that certain negative practices, whether that's, you know, hyperconditionality or certain critique alternatives or the state's counterpoint or whatever, is that they're really an attempt not to engage with the arguments of the other side. And so they kind of hurt the fundamental reason that we do debate, which is to engage in arguments and to engage in ideas and then from that to learn something. But then the other thing I want to mention just with regard to the coach thing, because I think that was, I mean, I'm obviously on board with y'all's opinions, is that just kind of the history of debate disproves the arguments of these people that if you are a debater who is, you know, has evidence cut for you by your coach, you will not be learning anything. I think that's just preposterous in the face of empirics. At least at the college level, coaches have been cutting cards for you know, 30 years or 40 years or however long it's been, and it's certainly been a prominent practice at in the college and high school levels for at least the last few decades, and a lot of the debaters that have been trained in that method have become very exceptional people, scholars, you know, lawyers, whatever. And so I just don't think that there's any empirical support for the claim that when coaches cut evidence or when coaches are more active or involved in debate that students are hurt. That argument just doesn't seem to be true empirically, even if all of the arguments that people are making should be correct. I just don't think they are correct empirically.
I wanna qualify a couple things. The first is I do think that we should have a tournament where the judges aren't allowed to disclose, mainly because every high school debater thinks they win every single debate. So the shock on people's faces when they're not 6-0, it'll just be funny enough because I know all my teams think that they win every single debate they have. So it would be interesting to make kids sort of guess what their actual records was. With, like, regards to evidence cutting and stuff like that, I think that there's sort of, there's a middle ground. And I think that as I, like, started coaching more, I kind of realized this a little bit more, is that I think that cutting updates and doing, you know, like writing a politics dissent or something like that ultimately is like something that coaches can do well. But I think that one thing that I try to do a lot is to have my older debaters and like especially the older 2Ns work largely on negative strategies against the big affirmatives that they're going to be debating. Because I found that when they do those case negatives, that they are much better at debating them than if, you know, we were to produce a negative that might be better than the student's negative, you know, assuming I did it, it would obviously be better. Maybe not everyone on my team and stuff, but it would be better than the negative they did, but their lack of knowledge on the issue would prevent them from executing it as well. So, you know, big core case negatives, you know, my 2Ns will work on so that they know what they're talking about when they give those 2NRs. Whereas if I were to do the negative and they just highlighted it before the tournament or before the debate, their knowledge on that might not be as in-depth. So I think that there is a middle ground that's good that, you know, give their debaters some responsibility and some serious assignments and make sure that they're doing important work. But that does not mean that as coaches, we shouldn't be either cutting some strategies, some counterplans, doing dissad updates at the tournament or anything like that. You know, those discrepancies and resources will always exist, but, you know, give your kids core work. Don't tell them to just sit there and look pretty. Tell them to do work and also supplement their work with important research.
Well, I think I have two kind of rebuttals to what Roy just said. One is that, obviously, if you do a file, you're going to know more about it than if you don't do it. But taken to its logical extreme, then, you shouldn't share evidence among teams because every kid should just do every negative themselves. I mean, obviously, there are logical limits on that process. And second, and kind of related to that, is that, I mean, even times have changed, even from when, like, we were in high school. Like, I mean, kids today, like, have 4 or 5 hours of homework. I mean, when I debated, I cut all of the cards that I read, but I didn't pay any attention to any of my classes all day. And then I would go home and I would cut cards instead of, like, I don't know, talking to girls and not being a loser. So, like, I don't really think it's reasonable to expect kids to be able to do all of the work themselves. I mean, just look at, like politics. Like, I read politics articles for, like, 6 to 8 hours a day. Like, if a kid wanted to do that, just have politics and not have any case negatives or anything, you know, there's no way they would be able to keep up with that. I just think that you can't be competitive and do it all alone. Like, it's just impossible.
Well, yeah, it's not all alone though. There's, I mean, obviously there's some middle ground. But how much do you think, how many hours a day do you think is reasonable the kids should be able to do debate work a day?
Well, I mean, I think if you have a kid who's doing 2+ hours of debate work today, you have an exceptionally dedicated kid.
Are you serious? I mean, maybe like we have, I mean, we practice, our kids are, you know, our seniors take the debate class, which is an hour a day, and then they stay from 3:15 to 6 p.m. every single day.
I mean, that's unbelievable. I've never had any kid come anywhere close to that level of dedication.
I mean, maybe that's like, I think ours might be like, we might practice more, but the kids are in there for the most part doing independent study, independent research, you know, for a large chunk of that, and that's Monday through Friday. I don't know, maybe that's more than normal, but...
Yeah, that's definitely a lot more than normal.
I guess.
I mean, 4 hours a day, that's a lot from the kids that I've coached. That would be a lot.
I think the logical result of the philosophy that those who oppose disclosure and kind of open casebooks and coach-generated research and all that is almost like a DDEV position, because the quality of debates would definitely go down. They would be smaller. I just think the quality of the activity in general would be a lot worse. You couldn't really have politics disads, and you couldn't have extensive case strategies, you know, and there would be a lot more debates where one team is prepared to defend, you know, give an affirmative or a K or something, and the other team just wouldn't have any responses to it. And I just don't think that would be, even if in the abstract it would be better for students to do all of their own research, I think that the result of that philosophy is a game that is much less rigorous and much less educational in light of the many things that students have on their plates in addition to debate. And also just in terms of debaters' ability to do work, you know, especially during their high school years, they're learning how to do debate research, and having coaches generating debate research alongside them gives them a model. It helps teach them how to do better research, and it just makes the quality of the game better, so that debate is more, there's more motivation for them to invest the work, whether that's, you know, 20 hours a week or whatever the Woodward students do, or even if it's, you know, only 1 hour a week or 2 hours a week for somebody who's less committed. I think that the coach aspect, the coach involvement, and the ability to find out what other teams have read, what research other teams have done, and then to find that research and replicate that research or write responses to it or whatever, I think that has fundamentally improved debate. I agree with Scott that between the time that we were in high school and now, I think there are a lot more demands on students' time. But I do think that the quality of debate has gotten a lot better. I think that there's a lot of reasons for that, but one of the reasons is that there's a lot more disclosure of arguments, there's a lot more citation sharing, there's just a much more open culture. And so now when you go to a tournament, you kind of know what kinds of arguments, what kinds of cases you need to prepare for, and that can only be good. And I think that the LD community's disdain for that position or whatever is just very strange, and I definitely think they're on the wrong side of that debate, and that, you know, the Green Hill tournament, which enforced that restriction, you have to disclose, you have to share your citations, I think that's definitely the wave of the future in LD, even if it takes a year or 2 years or 5 years or whatever. But hopefully it'll happen sooner than later.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I didn't think about, and Scott brought this up, and that's probably the best point, is that I don't know that it's harder to do research now, but there's just so much more to research. Like, if you think about it, when we were in high school, there was Lexis, and then there were books.
Like, I didn't even have Lexis when I, well, the first time I ever saw Lexis, I was...
But you know what I mean? There was like, sort of like, you either had books, the newspaper, and then if you had like access to Lexis, that was big.
When I was in high school.
So it's like, there is so much less to cut now, and with the advent of the internet, and just like the rapid development of that, like, I mean, when I was a senior in 2001, people were like, you guys should use this Google thing. It's pretty good. It's got lots of stuff on it. And we're like, whoa, Google. I mean, when I was at debate camp, you know, three people had laptops. Now almost all the labs have, everyone has laptops and Wi-Fi and this, that, and the other. So there's definitely merit to the fact that you could do politics research a lot easier than you could, you know, politics research then a lot easier than you can today, because there's just so many more articles today being written by every single person. So those demands definitely, you know, mean coaching, you know, coaches should be cutting cards and should be doing work, but, you know, kids still need to play a valuable role in that research at some level.
Yeah, I think the skill that students need to learn, and I think Scott might have posted about this, I don't know if it was on the 3NR or before that, or it might have been someone else, but the information processing and kind of learning how to manage information and how much you know, the vast number of sources that are available, the vast number of just kind of the vast raw material that is right at students' fingertips now is something that we need to teach students to cope with. And so it's not so much can a student go find an article that says XYZ, or can a student, follow the, you know, foreign affairs and foreign policy journals or whatever. It's can a student effectively deal with this abundance of information and kind of make sense of it, make order out of chaos. And that skill is certainly supplemented by kind of active coaching, coach-generated evidence, coach-driven research, things like that. Even if a coach cut all of a student's evidence, forcing, you know, the debate activity forces the student to make sense of that, to kind of to organize that, to make it their own. And that skill, you know, even for students who do very little of their own research and just go to local debate tournaments or whatever, I still think that debate is infinitely valuable for those students, because that's something that isn't something they do in any of their other academic classes. It's not, there's no other situation where they're kind of overloaded with information and then forced to organize it and deploy it in a competitive game. So I think even in the worst case scenario, or the kind of the worst case vision of those who oppose coach-generated research, which is where students do no original research, I still think that version of debate is valuable. And in practice, that isn't the scenario that has resulted from kind of active coaching. And so I just think that those people who oppose that are wrong on all counts.
Yeah, I think what Bill is getting at, and I've definitely really changed the way that I coach in the last year in light of this realization, is that I think the most important skill to teach kids to develop is the ability to read something once and be able to see, like, what is the warrant, what is the argument structure of this piece of evidence. And I think the reason that some debaters are so much better at debating files that they've put up together themselves is because they're not very good at being able to get a file, read it, and figure out what the arguments are without a lot of coaching. And I think developing that kind of independent critical thinking is the most important part of debate. And maybe that's what these people who are against coach-driven evidence, what they're really against is, like, coaches kind of blocking out word for word what debaters will say. And so if their affirmative is disclosed, the other coaches can see it and kind of program their little debate robots on what to say. But I think that it's just impossible to do that with everything. Like, no coach has the time to do that all. And so I think particularly when coaches are cutting a lot of cards, it's going to be useless to the kids unless they can process the information and come up with things. And like this summer, after practice debates, you know, if you just ask kids, like, they've read their 1AC five times, what's the warrant for why illegal immigration is affected by, you know, the presence of social services in the U.S.? It's, like, very simple. Like, immigrants want social services, so they come to the country. But kids, like, just read the evidence and don't think about the warrant and can't explain that part. And I think that, you know, that is a danger of coach-given evidence, but the people who fall victim to that are never going to be any good at debate anyway.
Yep, I agree.
I mean, that's 100% true, in that the robots will never be the best at debate. Like, those people who fear those robots and pre-programmed kids and all blocked out stuff, like, they can't think without help. They need that help, and I think that type of coaching and that type of, you know, that strategy for coaching will always fail. You have to have the kids thinking critically, and you have to have those kids know how to adapt to a situation. Can I talk about one more thing here?
Certainly.
That's kind of the other thing that we were talking about, like that reading thing that I was talking to you about. And this is something that I kind of figured out going on, was just that we seem to just rely on, like, Google News and looking at the NewYorkTimes.com and things like that for our news. And I just found that one of my favorite things to do is to, like, go to Borders and to, like, get the time, get, you know, U.S. News, get the New York Times, get those things and kind of read them. And it caused me to subscribe to the New York Times, you know, a week or two ago, where, you know, just reading the newspaper every day just makes you think about things. And the amount of articles and cards that I found just looking at the newspaper in different sections that I don't think I would have found doing a search is just astronomical. So if, like, you have a school that subscribes to your, like, local newspaper or gets, like, you know, a big name newspaper or something like that, read those newspapers, because Google News will give you, like, the updates and the things that are, like, the biggest things that are going on. But I found some just, like, ridiculous stuff in reading Time, the New York Times, all these things. And it's just stuff that you wouldn't come upon, you know, unless you knew that article was there. You'd never find it if you were just searching for that card. But it's just stuff that pops up. And you know, you should really think about doing those types of things to get yourself really to that next level where you just see more arguments and find cards that you wouldn't be able to find earlier.
Yeah, I think definitely the success of certain arguments, you know, I guess the best example of this may be the Cap K, where, you know, hundreds of debaters who individually did not do a lot of work, but over the years their, you know, little work here, little work there has been compiled, you know, from various colleges and high schools and whatnot, until now kids have Cap K files that are just unbelievable, that, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 people each put in a couple of hours of work to get the best single card on every issue, you know, just through the process of elimination and herded through the grapevine, that the reason these, like, you know, hyper-generic arguments are so successful is because these kids have these files where just countless hours by various people have been put into them, and then, you know, one kid spent, like, 20 minutes writing the Cap 2AC. And I think that what you're saying about, you know, finding new sources or just, like, reading the newspaper and whatnot, like, if you apply that to all areas, like, when kids go to do research about capitalism, you know, they need to, like, go and get books, and not just Google books. They need to get, like, actual books and, like, get into the process. And I think that's the maybe the toughest thing about debating critiques is that, you know, it's not like a healthcare politics disad where you can do a couple of Google news searches, cut 3 or 4 cards, insert your Plankeeta bipart link turn, and be done with it. It really does require, like, a much higher level of, you know, academic rigor because the arguments are so much more complex. And even, you know, Roy said time as an example, but I mean, like, if you're debating the Afghan troops disband, like, how many kids actually take the time to read, like, a foreign affairs article to learn about, like, what regions of Afghanistan we really need more troops in and why? It's, like, a pretty small number.
Yeah, for sure. That's one of the things I was going to mention before, but that reminded me, is just that even in addition to doing debate research, which I guess the definition of debate research involves two things. It's cutting evidence and, you know, writing files. But the part that we often forget about is just the part that's doing reading and to you just kind of familiarize yourself with the arguments that you're drawing from. And that's something that I think too many students don't do because they're very concerned with, well, I need to cut a bunch of cards, I need to finish this file or whatever. But if you're doing, you know, if you're doing the Cap K answers, it's better for you if you have read some more, you know, substantive articles, or if you've read a book about the capitalism debate, and you can understand the negatives argument, you can understand kind of where the authors that you're quoting are coming from, and then even if you just take, you know, some cards from a camp file or some cards that you've been given by someone else, you'll be much more able to make those arguments in a debate because you'll be familiar with what the authors are arguing, what the kind of basis for their claims is, where they're coming from, what assumptions they make, and you'll just be a much better debater. There are a lot of debaters who, even debaters who quote unquote do a lot of work, they don't do a lot of reading, and they're not really that familiar with the academic debate over the subjects that they're cutting cards about. And I think that's something where that can really be obvious in debates, in cross-exes, in last rebuttals, where it's obvious that one of the team or one of the debaters really knows what they're talking about and the other team or the other debater really doesn't, and that they're just kind of going through the mechanics of the speech, but they're not really sharing knowledge. And so I think that when you consider how much debate work someone does, I think you should include not just how many cards does that student do or how many cards does that student cut, but also how much time does that student spend reading about their affirmative or about, you know, negative arguments or whatever. And that can maybe be even more valuable than just the process of purely cutting evidence.
Well, it definitely is, because if you think about it, how many cards do you read in a debate round on a strategy? 30, 40 maximum? If you like have like a certain strategy, you're not going to read that many cards, but the analysis that you give, you know, your understanding and the expertise of what's going on is what will win you the debate. Obviously, having good evidence to support that will help, but, you know, you'll need 20 good cards plus a good amount of understanding to explain your argument in relation to theirs and why you should win. And that's where the reading and the understanding and all that comes into play. You know, most strategies don't take that much time to put together, you know, or that many cards to put together, but it's the time to put that strategy together where, you know, is where that time is spent.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, they take a lot of pride in how big their files are. So, you know, the debater will say, oh, I have a, you know, a 250-page hedge bad file or whatever. But in reality, they have 250 pages of cards, but they have very little understanding of the thesis of their arguments. They haven't done a lot of original reading. They don't really understand the background and stuff. And so I would rather have a 30-page hedge bad file with a debater who really understands the debate between, you know, the primacists and the offshore balancers or whatever than I would, you know, a student with a 250-page really good file that doesn't have that background experience. And I think that that's probably why K-teams or K-only teams have had a lot of success is because they might only have, you know, their Cap K or their Nietzsche K or whatever, but if they've done some reading, they're going to know that argument much better than the affirmative will. And so they're able to win debates, even though the affirmative objectively has, you know, better cards or is on the right side of the argument or whatever. And so I think that, you know, that doesn't have to just be a K-only thing. That can be a, you know, a hedge bad thing or a growth bad thing, or it can just be an F thing. You know, if you want to debate the free market on the neg or whatever, I think it's important for debaters to take seriously the charge that they need to know what they're talking about, and that knowledge of the background and the controversy in the literature about whatever it is they're debating can be more valuable than just having more cards or even having better cards, because the ultimately the debating is what wins most debates. Even in cases where judges, you know, prefer one side's evidence to the other, it's still in a lot of ways conditioned on how the argument was debated. And if you know the argument better, even if you don't have as many cards as the other team, or even if your evidence isn't quite as good, you'll probably come out on top in front of almost every high school judge, especially.
Yeah, and I think that that's like one of the key things about having coach-produced evidence is that, you know, when I was in high school doing it all myself, when I did a case negative, it would be like the biggest one I ever did was maybe 30 pages, because you just don't have time to get into the in-depth and everything. And so one of the things that was tough for me when I got to college is I was just not used to having super in-depth technical debates about something, because I was so used to just doing a superficial case hit or something. And so I think that's like a pretty big change for a lot of kids.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, work is hard, but it's fulfilling. It gets you wins at the end of the day. It's important. I wasn't really listening to what you said, so I just figured I'd say something about work. oh yeah. Do we want to talk about one more topic, or do we think this is a good cutoff point here?
We can do another one if you want.
All right, speed. Special extended podcast.
Extended podcast. This will be the last segment of today's show.
The last segment. Do you guys want to do the new app thing, or we got the word pick? We got a couple different ones to kind of pick from, or the T poverty line.
God, we didn't get to any of these.
We didn't get to any of our suggested topics.
Well, that's actually enough topics for like a whole other show. Maybe we should just cut this off.
Maybe we should just do that in a second podcast.
Yeah.
A special edition.
I was going to rant about something, though. Yeah. Oh, do we want to talk about that bus thing that we got, that you and I referenced?
Yeah, Bannerman, I don't get this bus post at all.
We're talking about Ryan Ricard's post that, of course, since you are just a homer for everyone, is like, this is a wonderful post. Have you ever seen a not wonderful post, Betterman?
Well, I do read all of your articles.
Everything is wonderful and magnificent and beautiful and this, that, and the other. And I read that, and I don't know Ryan Ricard well. We've probably talked a little bit before. And I, you know, this is not necessarily me saying that, you know, what he's saying is not important, but our whole article seemed to be like, people don't want to be teachers. We're screwed. And he references that in one line. He's like, this could be a problem in general education. And I kind of think that it is. It's like, yes, people who get trained by math, you know, great math teachers who convince people that they should be mathematicians, you know, those people end up going off and doing math-related jobs. Or people in physics who have like a great physics teacher might end up becoming physicists and work for a scientific company. Like, I think that the whole point is the way you should teach debate is you should not teach people to be debate coaches. You should teach them to love debate like debate educators theoretically do. And if they love it like you do and they like teaching, they'll want to become educators and involved in it. I don't think that anything happening today is different than anything else, and I don't know how embracing the fact that I'm going to get hit by a bus, like Roland Barthes style here, is going to make any difference about it. I think that, you know, debaters, some people will become debate coaches and some people will become teachers, and, you know, yes, we should make teachers' jobs more lucrative because that means I'd make more money and more people would join in it, but I don't know that this is like a unique crisis that we're facing in the community today. And I'm not wrong about this. This is not debatable.
Well then.
I mean, do you disagree, Scott? Do you disagree, Bill? I mean, Bill obviously disagrees.
Well, I mean, I guess I don't know.
He thought this was a wonderful article, but.
Yeah, well, I just think, I mean, I don't think that he was, isolating a imminent crisis. I think his argument was just that.
No, he was. He said, we were about to get hit by a bus. I started looking to the left and to the right for the bus.
He's talking about individual debate coaches. It can be kind of depressing.
Why? What does that mean? Like, yes, debaters go on to be lawyers and do other things. That's happened for the last, like, forever.
He's not saying that that's a bad thing. I think, I don't know, I mean, I know you're not, super involved in Georgia debate, and I'm not sure what the, you know, the situation is with regard to Georgia debate, but in Wisconsin, I'm, you know, relatively involved in our Debate Coaches Association, and there are a ton of high schools in the Milwaukee area and just in Wisconsin in general that don't have coaches, that have recently lost coaches, and it can be very frustrating. Sorry, go ahead.
But that is because teachers' salaries suck. That's not like a debate coaches people. That's not like people are like debaters, because the first part of the article is like debate trains people to like become high powered people. Like,
but
yeah.
I think let me explain what I think the argument is, and then you can disagree if you want. But I think the position, the reason that I thought it was an intelligent article is that. Maybe that is one of the reasons that debate coaches are, you know, there's a shortage of debate coaches, but I think that one of the other reasons that there is a shortage of debate coaches is that we don't give enough emphasis, or we don't emphasize enough, I guess I should say, to our students that is something they can stay involved with, even if it's just for a few years, even if it's temporary. And then beyond that, that a lot of us tend to treat other debate coaches in ways that, you know, kind of trivialize what they're doing. So in Wisconsin, there are a lot of debate coaches that just coach public forum debate or just coach student congress or whatever. And it's easy for us, you know, people that are much more involved or that think that policy debate is so much better or that our style of policy debate is so much better to kind of, you know, talk down to those people or to make them, you know, feel unwanted or unimportant or whatever. But the net result of that atmosphere or that ideology is that there are a ton of high schools, even high schools that are willing to support debate in an economy where that's difficult, that can't attract any faculty support, can't find assistant coaches or whatever. And so we need to be better as coaches about training our students to stay involved, convincing them to stay involved. And, yes, they'll become lawyers, and, yes, teachers don't get paid enough, but we kind of need to embrace the fact that, recruiting and retaining debate coaches is the only way that debate will exist. And so it's easy to say that, you know, it's just a problem with teacher funding or whatever. But if that's the case, we can't just throw up our hands and say, it's okay that there aren't enough debate coaches to fill the positions. And so I guess that's why I thought that article made sense. I didn't see it so much as a, you should jump in front of the bus. I guess that's his analogy or whatever. But I think his argument is just that we need to focus a lot more as coaches, as active coaches, on improving, increasing the recruitment and retention of coaches, because chances are we won't be in the activity forever. Most people won't be in the activity forever, but the more we can maximize their participation while they are in the activity, the more opportunities students have to participate, even if it is a form of participation that isn't necessarily the best, even if it's public forum or a form of policy debate that we don't approve of. So that's why I thought that Ryan's article was, compelling to me.
All right, I basically have two points to this. First is I think that debate is unlike any other activity that you need a coach for in the high school setting, in that the skills debate teaches you makes you highly marketable in other enterprises. Okay? And what I mean by that is that if you play high school football, and even if you play college football, if you don't go pro, there's not a lot that you can do with that skill set So it's natural for you to transition into some kind of coaching role. In debate, if you're really good at critical thinking and research, you're going to kick ass in any number of jobs that are going to pay you a lot more to be a debate coach. So it is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy that the better you teach someone to be at debate, the more options they will have and the less likely they are to become a debate coach. And I don't really know that teaching kids that debate coach is an option is a good counter to that. I just don't think that for a lot of kids, they're going to make their decision based on anything other than their perceived long-term success. But second, and I think more important in terms of retention, is that I don't think high schools understand or acknowledge the difficulties of being a debate coach and the commitment required in terms of, you know, making accommodations for you when you have to go on trips, paying people what they deserve for doing that job and whatnot. And so I think the main problem is not so much that, like, it's the economy or anything. It's that after a couple of years of traveling for 20-plus tournaments a year and getting back at 5 in the morning and having to go and teach at school that day, that's, like, it's not very glamorous. And so I think people's love for the game is quickly outpaced by, you know, just the utilitarian constraints of being a debate coach. And so I think that, more than other coaches gossiping, is both what drives people out, but more particularly is what drives out really dedicated, good coaches that are what's needed to kind of keep debate going.
Well, it's definitely tough, and I mean, there are some people who do this forever who, like, I just, like, don't get how they do it. Like, Bruce Miller, you know, he loves traveling to debate tournaments, and he's got a family and this, that, and the other, and he's, like, traveling every week. But I think that Ryan's definitely right that we shouldn't, you know, alienate other coaches, and, you know, like, whatever I said wasn't meant to, like, offend him, you know, and, like, we definitely need to be more inclusive of, like, people. But I don't think that we're, like, we're obviously facing a huge crisis, but if you look at, like, us three, and, you know, I'll forget some people, but, like, Eric Forslund, Maggie, Greenstein, you know, other people, they're like, there are a ton of young coaches our age who are involved in this activity. You know, I think it's like, obviously there's not one for every school, but I don't know that, like, we were compelled by Melissa Wade to become debate coaches. She might have told us we didn't have any other options, Scott. But, I mean, other than that, I mean, like, we sort of became debate coaches because this is something that we liked. And I think that if you teach people to love debate, then they'll, you know, and they are interested in teaching, they'll want to do it. You know, I don't know that you can convince a debater any more so than any other student to become, or any less, you know, so than other students to become teachers. They have to want to do it, and they have to like what they're doing. You know, and that's kind of the issue. I don't think it's like, I don't think we've got a crisis. I think that we just need to realize that, you know, obviously debate is difficult and it's taxing on our time, but, you know, the people who love debate and who want to continue with it will keep doing it.
Yeah, that's fair.
Which is why we do this podcast, because we love debate. Sure as hell not because we make any money for it. Right? No? Are we making money? Are you guys holding out on us?
Of course not, Roy. We make no money.
Good. Although we would certainly be willing to accept donations if anyone wants to cut us a check.
Yeah, if you want to donate to the Get Bill Batterman a Skype microphone for the Podcast Foundation, feel free to send in checks.
Well, is this going to conclude the podcast part due?
Yeah, I think it's a wrap.
And for those of you all who emailed questions, David Mullins, Alex Gulikov, Whitney Brent Whitmore, amongst others, we will try to get to your questions in the next podcast. They'll be at the top of the queue for next week.
All right, so thanks for listening. This has been Scott Phillips along with
Bill Batterman and
Roy Lefkowitz.